This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to Inside Voices. I'm Kevin T. Porter. My guest today is Jessica McKenna. Okay, a little background. Jessica McKenna is an actor, an improviser, a musical improviser at that, and she started the podcast Off Book with her partner and co-host Zach Reno, in which they and a guest perform an entirely improvised musical. Actually, perform feels like an inadequate word for what happens on Off Book, because the podcast is this gorgeous little container for the act of creation. It's not just an interesting conversation or topic-oriented. It's an unmitigated expression of joy entwined with the high-wire act of being silly and funny and sweet and also rhyming. There's a lot of rhyming. Here's a clip from the show so you can hear what I'm talking about.
We're fresh, we're fly, we're lit, we're dope, we're real, we're in it, we're 100, we're AF.
Yeah, lit, live, AF. Are you guys straight fire?
Straight fire. Actually, that's the name of our label.
Yeah, and we have a bunch of perks that we could offer you should you choose to join with Straight Fire Productions.
Do you want to swim in a pool but only on a big floaty? You can do that. Do you want to drink a drink but has straw but also an umbrella?
You can do that. You want to be on a beach with no one else around? You can do that.
You can do that.
It's a private beach, there's other people. And if you want a clown, a party clown with bottle service, you can do that.
But if you want to take your dreams higher, you gotta sign right now with Straight Fire. And if you want to take your dreams higher, you gotta sign on the dotted line with Straight Fire.
Should I read the contract?
No! You cannot do that. That's one of the things.
Jess herself is lovely, an unflinchingly positive person, and someone you really want in your corner. And after talking with her for 5 minutes, you already feel like she is. Plus, she did me the courtesy of giving me the episode title in full.
Jessica McKenna has a scrappy voice.
I knew it was going to be something like in this vein. Because most people are obviously like pretty self-deprecating or negative about the way they sound, or they have like a negative relationship with it. But I knew yours would be somewhere in the family of wholesome. Do you know what I mean?
Yep. Yeah.
Or optimistic or positive in a way.
Yes. Yes. I think that's fair and true and perceptive of you.
Has it always been this way? Like, have you always been like kind of an optimistic, bubbly, like a camp counselor that you wish you had? Growing up.
I was a camp counselor.
Is that true? Of course you were. What?
Of course I was. Come on. At a theater camp. Let's be real. Yes, I think in ways good and bad, I am a barely evolved person from the 10-year-old that I was. I think I'm one of those people where if you like met me as a kid, you'd be like, yep. Like if I could time travel my kid self into this conversation right now, it would be like, no surprises. That's exactly how I still sort of am.
Well, and it's one of those things where I think people who are known for being very positive or like natively have a sunny energy, there is this underlying question of, okay, but like for real, like the whole like impetus of some of the Mr. Rogers stuff in the interrogation is like, yeah, okay, but he like did a crime, right? Or like this, like that, that surely there's some like facade to it. So I think people are very envious of people who have naturally sunny dispositions though, right?
They, yeah, I mean, listen, I have, yep, I just, I, there's almost no moment in my life where I have any grounds to complain. So I just like...
Do you know how rare that is for a person to be able to say that though?
Yes. And that's why I know I can't complain.
Right. But I'm saying even people in with similar lots in life as you, not even like people who are super oppressed or marginalized in a different way, but I'm saying even people with similar lifestyles would be like, yes, but of course I have anxiety and depression and every waking moment is a nightmare in my life. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like people can always find the cloud and the silver lining.
Oh, yes. And, but I mean, like, those people probably have real clouds. I just, like, I don't really have them. And that must make me obnoxious. I don't know.
No, not obnoxious. Just like a curio, like truly a standout in all senses.
I mean, I certainly have bad days, and I have times when I doubt myself, and I get, you know, sad about rejection or things being hard. But really, I don't know what it is. I think I have like a fair amount of just delusion propped up on privilege and parents who believed in me. And so it makes for a concoction of a lot of unearned confidence and a lot of just like, well, I don't know, probably not that bad.
I mean, the parents are a huge factor, right? I feel like that's a make or break for most of us.
Yes, I'm also like the youngest of three, and we all were interested in the arts, but I'm the only one who pursued it long into like my, like who kept trying at it. And so I have very much a role in my family of just like, yep, carry that banner, girl, keep it going. Like, it just truly, you can't complain. You have to be sunny if you have been given no adversity. Like, if I was a whiny baby with the lot that I've been given, I mean, come on.
I know, but this is just so antithetical to, I think, most people's common perceptions of people who do comedy. Like, obviously,
oh, sure,
like,
sure, it's sure, just sure. Like,
okay, what's the thing? What's the thorn in your side that made you this way and all this stuff?
And I think that I used to fall into the camp of like, I guess I'll never be great because I don't have pain. And I think that honestly, some of them, no, that's destructive. That's a destructive way to think that greatness can only be born out of pain. And I think like people, we shouldn't make people feel like they have to preserve their pain to preserve like their artistic, merit. I want people to like be able to get help. but I feel
I know
like
what you mean, because it's like, it's an easy narrative to propagate, because it is like that's the impetus of all the difficult genius stuff. And that's the impetus of like, oh, well, he was horrible, but he did Thriller or whatever the case may be, or a less specific example.
Right. No, I feel you. And I agree. It's, yeah, I think this is like years ago, but probably when I was like first coming out of college and trying to get into comedy, I was like, I might not ever have anything to say. And sometimes I still feel that way, but not because of like a relationship to pain, just of like, I wonder if what I'm saying matters.
That's real. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like I went through that. Like I remember, I grew up in like suburbs in, Houston, like a little bit north of Houston called Kingwood in Texas. But I went to church in a church further near downtown, down south. And it was more in an inner city and more of a multiracial community. And the people I met through that, and their experiences and the kind of people and the character and the integrity that they had, made me feel, even at that age of like 10, 11, 12, kind of embarrassed and ashamed of have I gone through anything significant? At 12, I'm thinking this, mind you, but just like, have I gone through anything significant enough to have anything to contribute to the world or give back in any meaningful way?
Boy, and I feel like it's important to ask those questions for just the moment to moment stuff of like, is my voice needed in this moment, in this space? I think that like having a little bit of a hand on that check-in is good. I think having like a distorted view of like, you can't be funny if you don't have pain, and we need to celebrate tortured geniuses, even if they're terrible people. I'm like all for eradicating that narrative.
Right. And I think people like you do, honestly, because I feel like it's a lesson that most people learn at a older age, where it is, oh, what it takes is seeing an example of a person you find excellent who doesn't seem to have like all this stuff in their closet or all this, like, you know what I mean? And just like seeing,
totally.
Seeing the corrective example of that, of like, oh, okay, you don't have to do that. You can do another thing.
I think like art is a tricky area because there are like great geniuses in art, but I also like, and I've always reacted well to this thought of like, you also can be sort of a craftsman of it. You can be, you know, like just because it's an industry that produces greatness and geniuses, there's also like lots of, I like thinking of it as also something that you can just work at and you can like just be a craftsman at. And like, I don't have to paint the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. I could be like the person bringing over bricks, you know?
yeah. Or mixing the paints together. I know what you're saying. Like that, and that is necessary to think because otherwise it would destroy you if you're not immediately right. excellent.
Right. Exactly. I think you can strive for excellence in your own work ethic and your integrity and making sure that like you want to grow and evolve. But you also, if you're not a genius, it doesn't mean you like can't contribute.
No, like, totally.
We have scientific geniuses, and then we also have really excellent scientists. You know, there's room for tiers in lots of industries, and we shouldn't think that art needs to be different.
Yeah, but art is something in working in any sort of media with visibility is something that favors the most prominence in a way, or the splashiest, flashiest stuff. So yeah. It's like in the field of scientific discovery, the guy who can do the test in 2 minutes instead of 5 minutes is as valuable as the person who breaks through and does this thing because his job isn't predicated on his visibility.
Right.
But in some ways with media stuff, our livelihoods or jobs are predicated on that stuff.
Definitely.
So it's a hard tension to like live in terms of like having earned humility about everything you're doing in a sense of like, interrogating your motives and like you're saying, checking in moment to moment, like, is this needed? Is this necessary? What is it that I'm actually trying to say? But then also needing to, just for like survival in some ways, as like a survival tactic.
Oh, for sure. I think also like for me, when I graduated from college, I had like the veil of pretension still over me of like going to a theater school and thinking that like what would matter most is like if I could do Chekhov in an abandoned warehouse for like 10 people and that would be me being like a true artist. And then after like a year, I was kind of like, honestly, I'd rather be on a sitcom and I shouldn't feel weird about that. And it's not just because of money, but it's also because of money, because I'll never make money doing Chekhov in a parking lot. And it's okay that I want to have a little bit of a life and stability and savings. And also, I've never seen Chekhov in a parking lot, but I've watched a ton of television and just the like the pretentiousness of what matters. And I think that like becoming a person who celebrates that entertainment is also great, like that we all need it, crave it, have it. It's part of like the collective culture. It's part of what brings us like comfort and reprieve. And I don't need to like look down on it.
Right. And that's like even part of like a discourse like poptimism, right? The idea that like what's valued as low art is as valuable as what is traditionally valued in the canon as the most yes. artistically meritocracy yeah. thing. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And I don't think that needs to extend to like not having standards. And like, I want to like make sure that we're still pushing towards not just feeding the same old stories in the same old packaging in the same old way and giving them a pass because some people like them. But I also think we don't need to be little snooty snobs about it either.
I'm so surprised to hear that was your takeaway after college, though, was going into the direction of Chekhov, because in like you said, being a camp counselor at a musical theater camp before, I would have assumed you would have thought like Broadway or Sondheim set the whole time, rather than like, no, what I need to do is like the Stanislavski method, yeah, or whatever after college.
Absolutely.
Was there a shift in college that made that was so dramatic to lead you to that?
I didn't go into college as a theater major. I went in undecided because I was like, I don't know, I might just need to be a lawyer. This might be just like the thing that I, even though this is the thing I've been passionate about since I was 8 years old, I might need to hang it up and be a lawyer instead, because I did mock trial in high school and was like very passionate about it. And I loved like learning about government. And I was like, okay, I just need to go be like a public defender and then maybe eventually like get into politics. And then I was like, actually, I still really like putting on plays.
But it's funny because the idea of lawyer and even mock trial is performance still. Yes. It's like you're doing your monologue and you're totally making your case. And
so I did mock trial at Northwestern too. I was like, oh, this isn't the same, because like the program was shifted enough where you needed to, when you object, this is such like a small, I'm getting so in the micro, but we had to like object with case law numbers as opposed to just like objecting. Like in high school, you can just object relevance, but relevance is like a massive, massive objection in reality. So you have to object like objection relevance 401, because it's this specific part of the law, that kind of stuff. And also the coaches were really mean, and we had to be at like tournaments in Iowa on the weekends, and I was like, I don't like this at all. I liked it when it was like my friends in high school and the teachers were like mentors who became like good friends, and I loved them, and we like won, and I, you know, it was everything that I love, like winning and improv and doing it as a team. And I didn't actually, I mean, I'm interested in the law, and I'm glad that I like learned about it, but so at like 3 weeks in, I started the process to switch to become a theater major. And at that point, it was too late for me to audition into the musical theater program, which is like a separate certificate at Northwestern. And if you're not in the program, you might not necessarily be in like voice lessons and things like that. And so I just kind of wasn't on that path. I got into the theater major the next quarter, but, and I made like a long form improv team and was like doing more of that. And then my sophomore year, they take like a couple more people into the musical theater certificate, and I did not make it. And so I was just like, I guess I'll just never do that.
So you got kind of derailed from it for like practical reasons.
Yeah, I just like didn't make that program. And so I was like, yeah, I guess I'm not as good of a singer as like these people, but I am like in this, I'm in two comedy groups and like I'm doing a lot of that. And so I guess I just won't really do musicals, even though I was in like two musicals in school. And I still really liked them, but I was kind of like, I guess I'm not good enough. And then I didn't make our senior showcase. So I was like, I guess I'm like not good enough to be like that kind of actor, which is why I always knew I needed to keep pursuing comedy. But I was also sort of in love with my acting teacher. And he told me, he was like, I see you going down these two paths of like, I know you're in like these comedy groups and stuff like that. And I was in one of those when I was in college too. And like a lot of my friends from that group have like gone on to work on comedy, and he literally told me, but I don't want to see you give up on Chekhov either. Like I see that side of you too. And I was like, you're right. I must do this. Cause
right. And that's why you start your Chekhov podcast last year, where you go through scene by scene of every play he's ever done.
And now I'm going to play Uncle Vanya. It was really like, that really was the main reason. Now I was like still going to pursue comedy. Like I started taking classes as soon as I got to New York, but I was like, I also need to be in serious plays.
But then what fully shook you from that?
I tried to audition for The Lieutenant of Inishmore that was going to be out here at the Mark Taper, because I couldn't get an audition because I wasn't in like the union. Obviously, I think they probably just had small auditions in LA, but there was like postings on like Playbill and stuff about like, and backstage about getting into the general for this audition. I tried really hard. And it just sort of like was the catalyst for me daydreaming about maybe if I get in this play and I'm doing it in LA, and then maybe agents will come, and then maybe I'll stay in LA. And then I was like, I think I'd rather just be in LA, and I think I'd rather just try to be in TV. So then I moved.
I mean, it's funny because all these like inflection points are very practical. Like, well, this didn't work out, so clearly I had to do this. I mean, not that like, I mean, I guess that's most of how life occurs anyway. It's not like, and that's when I realized that what I truly wanted.
Yeah, I think it was about like, I've continued to learn the lesson and continued to see value in making yourself more and more specific, and in a true like business mind side of this industry of like, well, what am I as a commodity? I mean, some of that gets kind of gross, but also some of it gets kind of helpful.
No, but it's like what we were talking about in terms of like visibility is important for survival. Not even like as an ego thing, but it's like literally you have to have an ego if this is what you chose to do.
Oh my gosh, come on.
Well, and especially in this,
of course,
in the space that you're in, though, I feel like in improv stuff and musical improv stuff lends itself well, maybe more natively to your flavor, but just comedy in general, it's not something where this is what's popular right now. Like the thing that you specifically bring, you know what I mean? So like that's what stands out in the sense of like scrappy, wholesome, positive, optimistic, sunny, bubbly. Like this sort of thing isn't just like, oh yeah, you know, it's another one of these. Or if it does, honestly, it feels like a grift. Do you know what I mean? Where it's like positive core. Like we see like positive, like some good news or something like that, where it's like, I don't think this is actually what you mean, but like that as a flavor to the comedy that you're doing just is like harder.
Yeah. Well, I think like also just knowing what you are good at and what resonates more from you. I think like people who do really like acerbic, dark comedy that can really, you know, rip something open is incredibly valuable, and I like a lot of that. I consume some of that, but I just don't think that that's what I'm as good at. Like, I think toe dipping in some of that, it just never felt like it sat as much with me. And I think comedy is still an area where you can like smell the authenticity of it. And I think that I think it would feel inauthentic for me to create stuff that wasn't optimistic, uplifting, because I think that isn't my worldview. And so,
right. So for you, this does feel like an authentic, I mean, as much as it is like a calculation of like what you were talking about, like, okay, what's the commodity here? But for you, there is an authentic, like, this is the worldview that I'm sharing, and this is the thing I actually feel like I can put out.
Yeah, I think the making yourself more specific is like, in my mind, it's been more about like cultivating the side of my stuff that is music-based that maybe wasn't always in the plan or in what I thought I would do, but just realizing how many fewer people work in music comedy and how that might be a good avenue for me to stand out and be a little bit more seen. I don't think I thought about it as much in terms of my tone or my point of view as much as I've just continued to refine that is where I not only like can add, because I feel like there's less of that, but also where it's going to be the most truthful, as opposed to me like trying on a bunch of hats, which I think is like what earlier comedy is for, is like, hey, do I like the way this feels? Like, does this resonate with me? Does this lead me to come up with really funny stuff? If I like take the darkest outlook on the world, does it lead to a really funny, amazing thought or joke or moment or move? It didn't for me. Like what led to that was me being like a really sensitive boy who just wants to support his mom. Like,
right. You know? The early years of comedy is for you to discover that maybe you don't have a Nanette in you.
Yeah. I do not.
You know,
but
Ms. Gadsby probably doesn't have an off book in her.
And maybe she does.
She might.
She might. Honestly, like this is what I mean is like, that's a genius. She's doing something incredible. And I can do something entertaining and fun for people. And maybe someday I'll crack like, not my Nanette because I, no, don't, that's so singular, but like crack my perfect moment of that meeting the right medium and the right story. Because I do like believe in my desire to just be like a person who puts stories into the world. And I think that there might be a time where like one of those stories is particularly resonant and good and has like more of an impact. But in the meantime, I just want to make sure that what I'm saying feels truthful to me.
Right. Well, and it's one of those things I think that we're all questioning to some degree in the last, definitely in the last couple of weeks, but then in the last couple of months, in the sense of like, what am I doing? Do I care? Is this good? Is this ethical in some ways even? And like interrogating those things truthfully, especially when if the aim and even when like the most authentic, truest parts of you still equates to what some people could dismiss as inessential frivolity in that way where it's like, the thing that I've like trained the most for and I really care about and I think I'm really good at and I think no one can do but me is at the end of the day, a nice break or a nice time. So like reconciling that with the state of the world and the need that exists is like really hard. It's something that I've had to do a lot in the last couple of weeks without a resolution to it.
My goodness, we all must ask that question. I don't think that there's ever one answer for it. I think like the answer is moment to moment. There are times where it is certainly not helpful. It is like certainly going to crowd the discourse that needs to happen. And then there are moments where it's very vital and very necessary. And I think you shouldn't assume just because you can say something that you that it needs to be heard in that moment. But I feel, I don't know, I don't want to like base my life off of anecdotal stuff, but we do get I feel like I have enough people who've reached out about what Off Book is for them that make me feel confident about it at least sometimes being necessary, whether or not that's every moment. And also there's podcasting's like an interesting thing because it's like, what's the difference between keeping your feed updated and the difference of like, okay, I'm posting about this 1,000 times. And like even that micro navigation of like, okay, well, let's still put an episode up, but we're not going to like promote it. But if people need it, it's on the feed, you know, like.
Yeah, and the delicate, because that is relational in nature.
That's what I mean. I think like that context is, there's no one answer I would give to like, yeah, how do we feel about the fact that this is ultimately a little frivolous? Now, I do think that like we try to have stories that are about like compassion at their root and empathy. And I think like, you know, movies are empathy machines, art is empathy machines. And so even if it's ridiculous, I think that we try to still, if it happens organically, that's a hard thing to like manufacture in improv. But if there's an opening to seize on a storyline that is going to be about compassion and empathy, we definitely like seize it and jump on it and, you know, use those moments as best we can.
I want to back that up just to the bird's eye view of the musical improv stuff in general, because I feel like I saw you and Zach for so many years do this stuff on stage at UCB. How did that partnership come about between you and Zach?
We were in a practice group that was like formed out of a 401 that I wasn't a part of. And then my friend Dan, who I went to Northwestern with and did improv at Northwestern, was on that team, and they had lost some members and were trying to like reconfigure, and he added me to the group, and that was in early 2011. And by that fall, or maybe it was like a year into it, Zach and I both became, he got on Herald, I got on Mod, and I think I was like, hey, do you want to do a bit for this Christmas bit show? Because we kept making like very similar moves. I was like, as I was getting to know him, I realized that we had very similar sensibilities. That group became a sort of musical group, and he and I had like similar musical backgrounds. And so, yeah, it was sort of just like a little bit of like game recognized game of like, oh, I was about to make that exact move. And I think when you see that in someone so often, I think like, we have a very overlap in our, we have a massive overlap in our Venn diagram, but we do pull each other in good ways, like a little bit to different sides.
How does he pull you?
He pushes me to be more, a little bit more brave and exacting. Like, I think talking about this stuff about like, we are more frivolous. It's a little bit more like, but I think he would push us to like, well, we should say this can, we can be a little more hard line. We don't need to just like infer. We can directly say like, something that is more of a stance. I think he pushes me on that side. He also pushes in our writing, like he really pushes the absurdity up. And I think I am sometimes the more like grounding voice in our writing. And then I'm also a grounding voice, I think, in our improv, where I like will more often play a character who has like, I'm just going to sing sort of a sincere song right now. Like we're gonna have like a beat where it's like not that funny, but
but it's good,
but it's maybe kind of good, or it's at least what this story needs. It needs like a moment where it drops down. I think if we were writing, I think we both do both, but I think he might be more of the joke machine and I might be more of the story structure person. But I think we like telling the same types of stories. We like telling the same, like, and our comedy comes from a very similar place.
Yeah. And it's, I've interviewed so many people and I've talked to so many people who are co-hosts, and the evergreen question is always just with your partner. And it's not even just for you and Zach. It's not just, we do the show together and we see each other a couple times a week or whatever. It's like, this is like an ongoing endeavor that you guys are so like professionally married to each other in a way. And with something that is that can be as intimate as the analogy with so many other people in partnerships is like, you know, it's like we're harmonizing with each other. It's like, but you guys are literally harmonizing with each other and like, and tracking each other. And
I'll say he's doing way more of the harmonizing.
Hey,
hey.
But it's one of those things where you don't want to be a Simon and Garfunkel. You don't want to be a cautionary tale of like ego stuff. And I think you guys coming up in like more like in the comedy sphere, if improv, especially musical improv, is more like theater campy and permission giving and like, yeah, come on, go. Like, I don't think of it as like cutthroat terribly. I'm sure there's like sects of it that are. But in that sense, I'm just wondering how you guys steward and honor the relationship to keep it going, like in light of all these like multiple avenues of pressure, in the avenue of like making a TV show together, of writing together, of making albums together, and doing a weekly show together and performing on stage together.
Yeah, I mean, he is like the second most significant, like it is quippy, but he is like my work husband for sure. I think, you know, he is an incredibly easygoing person, and he recognizes that I have like a little bit more, I'm a little bit more of like, okay, can we make like an itemized list of the goals and things that we're trying to accomplish? And great. And I'm going to share you on that Google Doc. And if I could just ping and circle back really quick about the items that we still have to do. And he sort of never chafes at any of that, at least not in a way that he makes known to me. He's like a true chill Santa Barbara, like Montessori school, like parents, cool parent. Like, he just doesn't have that vibe. And we also align very much in like, we believe in what we're doing and we believe in pushing it for a long game. And if that means that there are stops and starts, that's like the nature of it. But we have to keep pushing and looking at like other ways that we could continue to grow. And yeah, I think, you know, maybe like once a year we have sort of a state of the union, like organically, it'll be like, hey, let's like talk about what you think we need to really, you have this idea, but I sort of feel like our energy is best served over here. And what do you think we should? But pretty much, I think one of the reasons why I feel like we're a successful partnership, just in like our ability to still be working together. I mean, we've been seriously working together for like 7 years. And I think the health of it is because we have similar goals and similar work ethics. It's not like one of us is dragging the other. But yeah, we are like very, very intertwined.
I know. It's just something that feels, especially with musical stuff, it always just feels scary to me, you know, like it's scary to see just because you see the horror stories. But I do believe because of like the nature of the work that you guys put out, like it's not like one is a primary songwriter and this guy has the high voice, you know, like it is so entwined in that literal sense.
I mean, he does, credit where credit's due, he does compose all of our music if we ever put out a song. So he does definitely do more of the work on that front. And whenever we're in a zone of that, I do try to take like everything else off of his plate. But sometimes we don't have other things that we're working on, and it'll just be like, sorry, Zach, you have to go to music zone for like 2 weeks. And I'll just like be here fielding emails, I guess. But we are like conscious of that. And like, you know, he has like an additional credit on our album as being like the producer of it. I certainly like don't think, and I think it's nice if we are viewed as 50-50, but the reality is with specifically our written music, he's doing more work than me.
Let's take a break from Jessica's scrappy voice and we'll be right back with more Inside Voices.
This episode is brought to you by Philo. Do you love TV? Do you love saving money? Then Philo is your solution. Philo has shows, movies, and live TV for just $25 a month. You can even try it for free with their 7-day free trial. No contracts, no commitments, no hassles. Just a better way to watch TV. Never miss a minute of shows like the hit docuseries Where is Wendy Williams? Or classics such as Friends. If you can't get enough TV, then there's no better way to watch. Philo has more than 70 channels like BET, MTV, and AMC. And the best part? You can try it yourself with their 7-day free trial. Sign up today at philo.tv/poppods. That's philo.tv/poppods to get 50% off your first month.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome back to Inside Voices. And now, the rest of my conversation with Jess.
Off-book, the improvised musical podcast with Zach and Jess.
Hello!
Welcome to Off-book, the improvised musical podcast with Zach and Jess.
I am Jessica McKenna.
And I am Zach Greeno. Wait,
one of those things is a lie. Just one.
Two people in this room are Jessica McKenna and Zach Greeno has never existed.
That's right. I started doing guesting on more and more podcasts. And so Earwolf actually just approached me about making a pilot in 2016. And I was like, well, it should be musical improv and it should be with my partner, Zach. So we piloted that early in 2017. And by that time, we had just been doing so much musical improv with each other. And I saw it as to get into like the business side, I saw that like opening that they didn't have any, like specifically that network. And I didn't know of anything else out there in the podcast space that was musical in the same way. So it felt like, well, this might not be for everyone, but it will be very niche and specific.
Yeah, but that's what you want. You don't want, yes, it's another one of these. You want... Right. This isn't a thing yet, so do you want to make it a thing? You know.
Yeah, exactly. I think like we don't have any sort of cult of personality behind us, so it needed to have like its own, the idea needed to be what was going to make people go like, oh, okay.
And as an endeavor, it does feel so unique in that sense because there isn't like a lot of competition ideologically for what the show is doing.
There are more shows now, which is like great. I mean, like I think that's awesome.
Do you feel responsible for that in some ways?
No, I wish I think maybe we've helped spread musical improv to like improv scenes that already existed that maybe they started to listen to Off Book and they're like, oh, maybe we should start a musical team. Maybe we've like increased that. But I think that spread was already happening and there are teams that can claim credit for that, and I think it's also just the way that improv itself has grown as a thing and popped up in cities that eventually they'll probably get to a musical improv scene. But yeah, no, I don't think so. I think that's just the nature of like that thing growing and then having people come up from it and then wanting to do that as
so
well.
You and Zach are the sole godparents of that scene is what I'm hearing. That's interesting.
That's right. And everyone, you owe us, and you're welcome. And you're welcome.
And link to the GoFundMe in the notes. With musical improv, it is a point of fascination for me. And like with musical improv in particular, it does feel like there is this strange kismet that audiences respond to so,
yes,
incredibly and tremendously,
yes,
in the sense of it always feels like a magic trick. And it, yes, is one of those things where you're combining that old like cliche in the sense of, well, comedians kind of want to be musicians and vice versa. Mm-hmm. Although musicians can be actors and it usually works. Like David Bowie can do a movie,
yeah, definitely,
if he wants to.
Definitely.
It's hard for,
yeah,
it to work the other way around.
But I agree.
But I'm always just curious what the people making it and that are so adept at those things think is the like ingredient or the special sauce of that response. If it is just like, is it truly just like this weird Pavlovian, they did a rhyme and it made sense and I haven't heard it before. Like, you know what I mean?
I was listening to Conan O'Brien's podcast, and when he had Lisa Kudrow on, and they were talking about how they both rejected the like yay attitude of groundlings classes, which is where they met each other. And that is how I now feel about musical improv audiences a little bit. I'm like, you're giving us like way too much credit. And I think that it like reinforces bad habits sometimes. And there's like moves that you can make that are really like pandering to those expectations. And I think sometimes it hurts musical improv because like you sort of stop doing really good improv because you have this other thing that's happening. Now, I think when you're first starting out, it's a lot to spin both of those plates. So if you like have a great scene and then once you're into your song, it's actually not that, it doesn't have any comedic teeth anymore. You are just trying to like clench your fists and get through the song because it's really hard and you're learning it and you're new to it. And I absolutely get that. And I still make songs that way where it's like, that chorus was boring as hell. Like, what the heck was I doing? But now that I've been doing it very regularly since 2014, I'm like, well, I want it to also like have comedic. I want it to like pass mustard for what it is comedically or storytelling wise. I don't want to like rely on the fact that this audience is going to like it just because we sang.
I'd be curious to hear what you think some of the cheap moves are where people can sell themselves out.
I mean, setting up like a silly rhyme, rhyming a word that isn't a word and then calling it out, like talking about the fact that you're singing, you know, just lots of like...
Yeah, you're rattling these off like they are just like nationally known, like we all know what happens in these spaces when we get lazy. But it does speak to like such a sense of expertise with this stuff, and you've done how many hours at this point? You've
so
surpassed
many.
The Gladwell landmark, I'm sure.
Yeah,
a couple
and,
of times.
And like I do them too, because like in a full show every song's not gonna be awesome, and maybe it didn't occur to you, and what really matters more is you like helping your show keep the momentum. And if the only chorus you could think of is yay 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 here we are, yay 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 here we are, that's still better than abandoning structure and like riffing in an amorphous conversational song for 7 minutes because mm-hmm. like you couldn't think of anything better. So yeah, there are lots of pitfalls. I mean, I have lots of like nerdy, myopic, microscopic opinions about like the minutiae of musical improv. But I think that like the audiences have responded to shows in ways where I'm like, that didn't really deserve that response. And if you saw those same moves made in an improv show, you would see it. But because we're singing, you're not. And I think people just love music, and I get it. And that's what's so joyful about doing musical improv is like you can feel that energy, and you can feel you really are. It is like being a magician. You are blowing someone's mind. They can't understand how you're doing it. But the reality is you're doing it because you practiced.
And you're a craftsman at it.
Yes, because your brain got better. You've made those roadways of like what the A rhymes are, what the E. You've gotten better at setting it up so that the punchline comes second. Like once you do it 1,000 times, you can get a lot better at like, here are the small ways that I can make this better and stronger comedically. And I think that's what I really want to focus on. Of course, I do lazy bad songs. But like, I want them to still be funny. Like, I don't want it to just be like, I'm so amazed.
No, but I'm encouraged by all this because I feel like, I mean, and speaking of snobbery, I feel like this is probably way more prevalent in like stand-up circles. But people who are like road comics despising people who like bring guitars to their sets and like rely on that because they know it's going to get XYZ as
yes.
a response. It's really encouraging to hear that it sounds like you and Zach and most of your peers don't settle for what you know can work in like a certain context and are like always pushing yourselves.
Yes, exactly. Like, and I see I like the people I perform with or have performed with, like, everyone is like pushing themselves, but I also, I see it in myself, and I see it as like, oh, I want to make sure that we're teaching I want to make sure that we're not that, my gosh, this truly doesn't matter in the scale of things, but like up and coming musical improvisers, don't get swayed by the fact that your audience is going to be like automatically more wowed than you. Then like, just like performing, if you come off of Harold Night and suddenly you do a different show and you're like, oh, I'm not performing for improv students anymore who are just going to love how good that tag out felt. You know what I mean? Like, it's important to just like, in the same way you get in front of different audiences and realize, oh, I was really getting used to this one type of audience, and I was like, I became a person who pandered to their expectations, even subconsciously, because I'm used to playing to this audience.
I love how much you love this. Do you know what I mean? Truly, I'm not poking fun. I think it's terrific to, especially with a show like Off Book, because Off Book is not a show about something in that way of like, here's a topic, we're going to talk about it. What an interesting roundtable with fun, funny friends. But it is like a performance bubble, and you're making something that could have been disposable on a stage for like one night somewhere, lasts forever, kind of trapped in amber on the internet forever. And it sounds like you feel all these like different measures of like responsibility and professional work ethic, and also like compassion and empathy mandates and regards and imperatives to that. Like, I think it's so terrific how something that is like, yeah, it's a show where we like sing a lot. I know. And I can tell when I listen to it that you guys are thinking about it from like 25 different angles to it. And I think that shows in the show.
Thank you. That's really kind. I think that also that's how you keep it interesting for yourself and how you make sure that you don't rest on your laurels. I think we're interested in multiple ways that we put musical comedy content into the world. But I think we also love improv and want to make sure that like we're not doing lazy improv. And there is a different expectation on us because it is in amber and it is on the internet. It isn't the same as doing improv in a theater with just those 60 people watching, and then it's ephemeral and it's gone. So that is its own responsibility of like, hey, this is something that could be edited. So we don't have the excuse of like, well, it was all made up, because we have to like, we still have to vet that, yes, I stand by everything that happened in that episode. We don't like to edit the show because we want it to have like every improv truth in it. But we certainly do occasionally if we're like, that's not what we wanted. And we don't feel like we want to stand by that forever, whether it's us or a guest. And so maybe a handful of times we've like gone in and sort of like removed something.
Sure. Yeah. Not in like a artistically inauthentic way, but in like an ethically authentic way, I think.
Right,
that's like
which the, I think was, it wasn't immediately apparent because you take that for granted. You're like, well, everyone knows it's improvised. But so like, if you know, it happens sometimes on stage where like someone says something or they justify something in a way and they're like, that's actually, and you know, everyone on stage should call it out or in character or not and field it so that everyone in the audience can have that collective release of like, we saw that happen and we saw that dealt with. And now we can move on. And then if you leave that moment in forever in audio, it's like, well, that's a different choice. So we've only had to do it a couple of times and nothing too like crazy, but just, I don't know. I don't, that's not something that I need to be permanently out there. We didn't need to say that in that way. Musical improv is a big, scary, high dive for most people.
I know that's one thing about doing the show is like the ask on the guests, because most of the time it's like, oh, be vulnerable and be funny and interesting. And this is like, perform for an hour and do like do an act that you'd probably rather talk about very personal, private things instead of doing this. Sing sincerely, you know, even if it is on like a comedy show. So that's probably interesting, like trying to navigate the guest ask and like booking with that stuff.
Yes, it is.
Is that like one of the biggest challenges of the show?
Yeah, I would say. I mean, I think at this point we have enough episodes and we have enough different types of guests that we can usually use them as like, hey, so-and-so did it and they had fun. You really will be fine. We've built up a little bit of that, which is great. I think it is still always really tricky, and we understand that. And we try to like say, hey, if you want to come on and talk sing, and basically never sing, that's fine. Like, we can ooh and ah around you. We can set your chorus. There are things that we can do. Like, Betsy Starr was one of our earliest guests, and I don't think she sang basically at all, but she maybe like talk sang through some songs. And it's a very funny, great episode because she's still bringing something for us to like help. And obviously she's like singularly hilarious. So that's like an insane example because anything she touches turns to gold. But so yeah, surprise, surprise. Betsy was funny even if she didn't sing. But but I mean, like we have gotten even better at running that support of like truly come as you are, like hop in, be a part of it, but we'll try to like, we want to make you look good, you know, so don't be afraid.
Yeah, but it's something that I feel like even in listening to the show, it does, the kind of natural persona and energy of both you and Zach as co-hosts do extend to a permission giving like post lunch cabin rally in that camp, like truly, and like, yes. Okay, and now Betsy's gonna come up and do something. Yeah,
yes.
Everyone's going wild for Betsy. Although I imagine, yes, even in doing the show, that like, you guys have probably had to adjust some stuff musically in not having a live audience and a crowd to give you real time feedback.
Yes, totally. I think like at this point we make each other laugh, or like the guests will make us laugh, and there's like. And also, I've done so many more podcasts where you kind of get that sense of, I can tell when we're onto something. It's not as immediately helpful as a live audience, and it's not as like potent and sort of kinetic feeling. And that's one reason why like Off Book Live is so freaking fun, because it's the same thing. It's already so performative. And now we get to do it in front of an audience. So it's like giving it a real jolt of energy.
In addition to all these things you're talking about like refining things and holding yourself to high standards all the time, making sure you're not resting on your laurels. When you're 3 years into a show that is such a like high wire act in this sense every week, how do you find that sustainable for you personally? In the sense of like doing it and finding, I mean, it's different now because of like the way you've had to adapt with quarantine and like having to record in a completely different way than you had to before.
Yeah.
But like even beyond that, like as like a macro creative project, how are you looking at it for yourself?
I don't know. I don't want to like say something and this has not like been discussed, you know, but I'm also not afraid to end Off Book, you know, like I'm not afraid to say, okay, great. That's that version of that thing. Because I think we're interested in the place where comedy and music meet in multiple ways. We aren't just obsessed with musical improv, and we aren't just obsessed with podcasts. So I don't know. I think like there probably can and will come a time where I'm like, I can't keep this fresh anymore. Not in this way. I'm playing too many scrappy kids. I'm like, we did too many times where we were a chorus of bears. Like this is
a 12-minute supercut gets uploaded on YouTube of every time Jessica plays.
Totally.
Child.
Oh my gosh, it's way longer than 12 minutes already. So I think, but I think pushing it musically, every time a new guest brings new energy, trying to like push us to take on different genre stuff. There's been an evolution of the amount of band that we have, which has really helped to keep it musically diverse. But also I think just knowing when maybe this thing is maybe not viable anymore.
Yeah, which is a scary proposition because of what you were saying before about the positive feedback you've received. That is like deeply meaningful, even if it is oh, this helped in my commute, or this helped when I was depressed, or something like that.
Yes,
it's hard to. I think that is such a strange dilemma to look down the barrel of, in that sense of like, this means a lot to a lot of people, but I don't know what my place is, and even now, like, I don't know. I don't know how those decisions have to be personal for everybody, but I don't know how a person makes them.
I know, but I think about all the things that I love and they ended, you know, like, and I think part of something that we do have in our favor is our episodes are a little bit more re-listenable than some other podcasts, like, and they have stories and they have characters, and they're not tied to each other. Certainly some of them probably feel more of their moment than others, but I think we have fans who have said, hey, I have this episode I've listened to 20 times because this is my favorite, or
and they know the songs and they've made t-shirts of the lyrics and things like that.
So I feel like in that sense, yes, I will take that decision, really. I will take that on, and I'm sure we would like give our fans like plenty of notice so it didn't feel like terrifying. But and that is nothing I see is happening like hyper soon, but there will come a time when I feel like we have exhausted our ability for that thing to feel fresh and inventive, and less like the magic trick, which is like people can now see, oh yeah, they set courses and the structure is basically this, and they're, the second song's probably going to be an I Want song. You know, like how many times before people are like, yeah, I get it.
Yeah, you want to be Simpsons season 2 through 8, not 33 or whichever one they're on now.
Yeah, and then the other push and pull is like we still really love doing it, even if it doesn't feel as challenging as it once did. It still brings us a ton of joy to just sing, and singing is so cathartic and joy inducing that I don't know what I'd want to make sure that we were still singing and performing, because it just feels so good.
Yeah, but I love it when you frame it as a point on this like larger journey of the intersection of music and comedy, and what's like the perfect platform and the perfect kismet with all those things. Because it feels like, I mean, Off Book really works, right? Like the amount of feedback you've gotten and the validation, even from like live shows and stuff, and the kind of like fan base you guys have built up. It's like, okay, this is a green flag here in terms of like keep going, and like a green light for whatever the next thing would be. But
yeah, and I hope those people will come with us, and I hope that like that's how they see us, is a partnership that's trying to create all different kinds of content and not just as their like favorite podcast hosts. And I think that comes from wanting to make sure that, you know, Zach and I at the end of the day like want to be actors, like we want to be acting and stuff, and there's you want to make sure you're saying yes to opportunities and creating opportunities for yourself, but I don't want to accidentally wake up and, oh, because I was more insistent that this podcast kept going, I like wasn't putting as much effort over here. You know, we have limited resource, we have limited energy, and if it becomes no longer helpful, then I think we'll have to, you know, just decide that it's run its course.
Yeah, it's weirdly like a prison where you always have the keys, right? Where it's like, this is going to take up this much amount of my time and my energy.
Yeah.
And even with all these like good positive things, I do need to leave at some point. And I don't want to, yeah, like, and especially for like, for the aim and goal of what you guys are doing, you don't want to be like super boxed in by that. And okay, now we're doing this kind of musical podcast, I guess. Maybe it's not as good as the last one. Like you don't want to have diminishing returns with the same medium, or feel like you're losing that sense of discovery or exploration. So,
and also there might be, it might just be like, oh, actually we just needed to push through and we were going to run for 12 years because once we discovered this and we reinvent every four, who knows? I just like, you can't have, it has to be on the table so that you are really looking at it with clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose.
No, absolutely.
You can't lose. Absolutely. Can't be afraid to lose your podcast because it might bring you clearer eyes.
Hey,
and fuller hearts.
And you won't lose. But no, that's such a good point about like, because then it gets back to that thing you were talking about interrogating the moment to moment thing. So it's like, if you don't make it a given of like, yeah, this will be like the next 7 years of my life, and you do make it more of, is this good for the next 3 months? Okay. Is this good for the next 3 months? And truly reflecting on that for yourself personally and your professional and career aims. I mean, you guys are so much more talented than talented podcast hosts. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I don't even mean that as like a backhanded slam, but it's just like, there is a thing of like, this is, Off Book does exist as just such a funny container. It's not like, here's the platform and here's like beginning, middle, end. This is what this thing is. It's like, this is the container where you make the product that is like you and Zach together. And it's just like a container. But it's so clear to me as like a listener and consumer, it feels so clear that it is a container. It is not the apex or like the paragon of what's possible with the mediums, you know?
Thank you. That's nice. Yeah. And like, I feel like if this is how people get to know us first, obviously, I think that's great. And I love it. And I'm very proud of it. And it makes me so endlessly happy to get to do it and have people like it at all is like the, I mean, this is a very tough industry, and a lot of people are gatekeepers from you getting to put a story that you believe in out there. And it's such a antidote to getting distraught that we have something that we do get to just put out. and we do have control, and it doesn't get notes, and it doesn't have to be pitched to some CE who's not listening to you. What I would be afraid of is if in losing that, what would it do to our resilience? Because if we cut off that that sort of off ramp for that sadness, you know,
it's fair.
Yeah, because you know we've had big no's, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's nice, I think, to have a place where it's yes.
Yeah, it's a blank check creative yes every week for you guys.
Right. So if and when we said goodbye to the podcast, I think there would need to be something that was already in place or that had taken its place as like, great, well, here's where we're keeping on our toes and here's where we're keeping sharp. We're doing this and we're getting that joy and we're getting that energy that just sustains you through the harder parts.
I think it'll happen, right?
Gosh, I hope so.
There's that sunny disposition.
Or delusion. You know, we don't know.
It's
and
either.
It's best,
but it's it is
best
scrappy.
Not to tear it apart because it is working
and
it
is
scrappy.
Very scrappy and it's terrific. And I really love your voice so much. And I love your singing voice. We didn't even talk about your singing voice, but that's so terrific too. What a magic trick to be this talented. Thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Jessica McKenna has a scrappy voice, and you can hear that voice on Off Book wherever you get your podcasts. I don't know where you get your podcasts, and I respect the boundary that you've put up in not telling me. Inside Voices is produced by me and Steve Allman. Our theme music is by Pam Autori, and I'm your host, Kevin T. Porter. Thanks for spending time with us today on Inside Voices.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.